Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for being here on time and some of you being here very early too. And for braving threats of snow. It seems to be a tradition now with the coalition meetings in January. For those of you who aren't familiar with the coalition, it's a network of scientific membership organizations that recognize a role for science and scientists in human rights. All scientific membership organizations are welcome to join, as well as individual scientists, and to help contribute to our work of bridging the science and the human rights communities. Today, our meeting begins with a focus on Haiti and the role of science and human rights in contributing to Haiti's recovery following the devastating earthquake that hit on January 12 last year. The earthquake hit suddenly and with little warning. The scale of devastation caused by the earthquake overwhelmed the local response capacity and threatens to have an ongoing serious impact on the social and economic development of Haiti, which already rated just 149th of 182 countries on the UN's Human Development Index. Human rights offer not only a legal but a practical framework by which to assess and address the needs of the displaced and other communities affected by the earthquake. In particular, this panel will focus on the role of science and scientists in contributing to the human rights protections of Haitians left homeless, scarred and vulnerable by the earthquake. Scientists not only have a role in providing medical assistance, but also in identifying psychosocial needs, establishing communication networks for reporting sexual violence, developing survey methods for determining the prevalence of unemployment and homelessness, and in creating monitoring mechanisms to determine the effectiveness of measures taken to assist affected populations. In Haiti, an additional area in which scientists are vitally needed is in the area of mitigation. While natural disasters cannot be prevented, their impact can be mitigated through a comprehensive analysis of the risk, implementation of effective preventive measures, and widespread education and awareness raising. Tomorrow marks 1 year since the earthquake struck Haiti. We'll now hear from this distinguished panel about what has been done in the past year and how we as a community of scientists may contribute to the long-term recovery of Haiti. Fritz Desormes, our first speaker this morning, is an economist and vice-chancellor for research at the University of Haiti. You may read his biographical information in the notes in your meeting packet, but what those notes don't say is that Fritz Desormes has a particular passion for ensuring that technical assistance offered to Haiti is provided in a way that not only helps the country in the short term, but builds the local capacity in the long term. He will present his remarks in French, and Marie Marco will provide the interpretation.
Good morning. Pour commencer, un grand merci et des compliments à Jessica et à la section des droits humains de AAAS pour l'invitation pour cette session spéciale pour Haïti, pour la solidarité donc et pour la qualité des panélistes.
To begin, a great thank you and my compliments to Jessica and to the human rights section of the AAAS for this invitation, for this special section on Haiti, for solidarity, therefore, and also for the quality panelists.
Je ne vous cacherai pas l'émotion qui m'étreint ce matin, à la veille du premier anniversaire du séisme du 12 janvier 2010.
So I will not hide from you my emotion that I feel this morning, the eve before the first anniversary of the earthquake of January 12, 2010.
Je vous assure qu'il n'est pas très facile d'en parler, de se souvenir de cette catastrophe déjà immense à l'échelle mondiale et qu'il est encore plus à l'échelle d'un petit pays.
I can assure you that it is not very easy to speak of it, of this remembrance of the catastrophe that was already so immense on a world scale, but even more so on the scale of a small country.
Bien entendu, au-delà de la douleur, au-delà des constats, notre devoir de scientifique est de chercher à comprendre, d'expliquer, de faire comprendre, non seulement pour éviter la reproduction de tels moments, mais également pour apporter notre pierre dans la reconstruction, dans la refondation de ce pays meurtri.
Well understood. Besides the pain, besides the difficulties, our scientific responsibility is to try to understand, to explain, to make understood, not only to avoid this happening again, but also to put our stone into the reconstruction, that is, into the refounding of this injured country.
Je sais que je n'ai pas beaucoup de temps. Je me propose de montrer que ce qui s'est passé le 12 janvier 2010 en Haïti recouvre de flagrantes violations de droits humains et qu'il est le résultat de graves déficits scientifiques.
I know I don't have much time, but let me propose to show what happened on the 12th of January in Haiti and how it shows flagrant violations of human rights, and that this is a result of grave deficiencies in the scientific sense.
Nous considérerons les droits humains dans une perspective très large, incluant les droits civils et politiques, les droits économiques et sociaux, tant sur le plan interne que sur le plan externe, y compris le droit à la souveraineté nationale, le droit à l'autodétermination, le droit des pays à disposer d'un État.
We will consider human rights in a very wide perspective, including civil and political rights, economic rights, social rights, on the level of internal planning and also international planning, which includes the right to national sovereignty, the right to self-determination, and the right of a country to be a state.
La science est également prise ici dans un sens très ample.
So, also the science is being considered here in a very broad sense.
Elle inclut à la fois les sciences naturelles et les sciences humaines et sociales.
The science in this sense includes natural sciences and human and social sciences.
Et quand nous parlons de déficit scientifique, il peut résulter tant par indigence de connaissances, par ignorance, par manque de moyens d'y accéder, que par mise au rencard ou mise au silence de la science elle-même.
So, in speaking of scientific deficit, it can result by lack of acquaintances, by ignorance, by lack of means to get to it, such that there is a silencing of science and putting it in effect into the scrap heap.
En guise de conclusion et perspective, nous plaiderons en faveur d'une meilleure considération de la science dans tout processus de reconstruction d'Haïti. Elle doit se situer au cœur du processus.
Also, in the guise of conclusion and perspectives, we will plead in favor of better consideration of science in all processes of reconstruction in Haiti. Science must be considered in the heart of the process.
La touche des droits humains doit également être présente pour un meilleur cheminement d'Haïti, mais aussi pour une meilleure compréhension d'Haïti par le monde.
So the touch of human rights must also be present to put Haiti on the right track and also for a better understanding of Haiti in the world.
Mais par-dessus tout, il faut reconstituer les capacités de l'État haïtien et des institutions haïtiennes de telle sorte que la solidarité avec Haïti puisse porter les fruits espérés.
So in that regard, it's necessary to rebuild the Haitian state's capacities and also of the Haitian institutions in solidarity with Haiti, such that that could bring forth the fruit that we would hope.
Dans cette perspective, l'exemple du AAAS peut être offert comme modèle.
So, in this perspective, the example of the AAAS could be offered as a model.
Probablement, je n'aurai pas le temps de développer tous ces points.
Probably, I will not have enough time to develop all these points.
Alors, pourquoi parlons-nous de violation de droits humains? Ne sommes-nous pas, enfin à propos du séisme, ne sommes-nous pas en présence de phénomènes naturels qu'on ne peut ni éviter ni prévoir avec certitude?
So why are we speaking of a violation of human rights? Aren't we really in the presence of natural phenomena that we cannot avoid, much less predict with certainty?
Ici, nous voulons établir la différence entre le séisme, qui est un phénomène naturel, évidemment inévitable, incontournable, et la catastrophe qui en résulte, ou l'ampleur des dégâts engendrés, qui, eux, peuvent être évités ou du moins réduits.
So here we want to show the difference between the earthquake, which is a natural phenomena, certainly unavoidable, irreversible, and a catastrophe that resulted as a result of the amplitude of related damages that could have been avoided or at the very least reduced.
Je noterai deux points en ce sens. Il est clair qu'Haïti n'est pas le seul pays à connaître des séismes de cette magnitude, 7.3. D'ailleurs, moins d'un mois après, le Chili connut un tremblement de terre de 8.8. Le nombre de morts ne dépassait pas 1000 personnes.
So I will put forward two points in this sense. It's clear that Haiti is not the only country to have experienced earthquakes of this magnitude of 7.3. Besides, in just less than a month after that, Chile experienced an earthquake of a magnitude of 8.8, but yet the number of deaths never exceeded 1,000.
Depuis 2008, plusieurs voix scientifiques, haïtiennes et étrangères, se faisaient entendre, certaines avec insistance, sur la probabilité d'un tremblement de terre de magnitude supérieure à 7.
Since the year 2008, many scientific voices in Haiti and elsewhere made it clear, some of them actually insisting of the probability of an earthquake of a magnitude above 7.
De sorte que, même si la date et l'heure ne pouvaient être prévues, il existait la possibilité d'une préparation plus adéquate à l'événement et d'éviter des dégâts aussi importants.
So even if the hour and the date could not have been foreseen, there would have still been the possibility of more adequate preparation and at the very least fewer serious injuries.
Car on a vu au moment du tremblement de terre des gens qui étaient à l'extérieur et sont partis se réfugier à l'intérieur de leur maison, croyant que c'était la meilleure chose à faire.
Excuse me, we lost a paragraph here. Beg your pardon. What we have here is a situation of internally displaced people in their own country.
Alors, il est vrai qu'il existe des faiblesses graves au niveau tant de l'éducation que des ressources et des activités scientifiques.
It's true that there are great weaknesses in the level of education and in resources and activities scientific, of the scientific sense.
On peut citer, en ce qui a trait aux sciences de la Terre, par exemple.
So we can cite also earth sciences, for example.
Le nombre très faible de spécialistes.
The very low number of specialists.
L'absence quasi généralisée de filières relatives.
The generalized absence of associates.
La faiblesse des ressources qui y sont allouées.
The weaknesses of the resources that are available.
Le peu de cas fait à l'éducation scientifique de la population.
And the little attention given to scientific education of the population.
Ces caractéristiques se retrouvent d'ailleurs dans la plupart des filières scientifiques.
These characteristics are found also in the majority of scientific associations.
D'ailleurs, il n'existe aucune instance de l'État dédiée au volet science, technologie et innovation.
Besides, there is no instance of the Haitian government dedicated to the subjects of science, technology and innovation.
Au niveau de la société civile, il n'existe ni académie des sciences ni association scientifique.
And at the level of civil society, there is no academy of sciences nor any association of scientists.
Mais on pourrait approfondir le raisonnement et se demander pourquoi fait-on si peu cas de la science et de l'éducation scientifique, et pourquoi, même quand les normes existent, elles ne sont guère appliquées.
So we can deepen our reasoning and ask, why has so little been done regarding science and scientific education? And also, even if such norms exist, why are they not actually applied?
À ce niveau, il faut faire intervenir un deuxième niveau de déficit scientifique que l'on retrouve dans les politiques d'ajustement structurel qui ont constitué jusqu'à très récemment et peut-être jusqu'à présent le prêt-à-porter pour les pays en développement en matière de politique économique, servi comme une panacée par les institutions internationales comme la Banque mondiale et le Fonds monétaire international et des organismes d'aide bilatéraux, est présenté comme le dernier mot de la science économique.
So at this level, it's necessary to go to a second level of scientific deficiency that exists in the policies of structural adjustment that constituted until very recently, and actually till the present, what was necessary for countries, developing countries in the sphere of political economics and economic policies, serving as a panacea for international institutions like the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and bilateral aid organizations, that were presented like the last word of economic science.
On sait qu'il s'agit en général de politiques imposées et dont les résultats ont été les plus néfastes sur le plan de la croissance, de la distribution, du chômage, de la pauvreté, de la précarité économique et sociale et de l'affaiblissement de l'État.
We know that in general, the policies imposed and therefore the results were insufficient regarding the plan of knowledge, of distribution, of unemployment, of poverty, and the economic and social precariousness of the country.
L'échec de ces politiques ont été officiellement reconnus par la Banque mondiale et par d'autres instances.
These actually were well known in an official sense by the World Bank and in other instances as well.
Les confessions à ce sujet de l'ancien président américain Bill Clinton sont significatives à plus d'un titre.
Confessions on this subject by former President Bill Clinton are very significant regarding this theme.
Je cite le président Clinton, « Je n'arrive pas à supporter les conséquences de mes actions à l'égard des fermiers haïtiens en ce qui concerne la perte de leur capacité de produire du riz, donc de se nourrir. J'en suis le seul coupable. Cela a pu avoir été profitable pour quelques-uns de mes fermiers en Arkansas, mais ça n'a pas marché pour les Haïtiens. C'était une faute, reconnaît le président Clinton. »
And I quote President Clinton, I have to live every day with the consequences of the loss of capacity to produce a rice crop in Haiti to feed those people because of what I did, nobody else. It may have been good for some of my farmers in Arkansas, but it has not worked for the Haitians. It was a mistake, end quote.
Il importe de rappeler que l'une des caractéristiques de ces politiques, c'est leur aversion pour l'université, donc pour la production endogène de capacités scientifiques.
It's important to remember the characteristics of these policies, their aversion by the university, and as a result for the production of scientific capabilities.
Ainsi, le déficit scientifique, par manque de ressources ou par mise à l'écart de la science, explique largement l'ampleur des dégâts du séisme du 12 janvier 2010 en Haïti.
Also, scientific deficiency, lack of resources and lack of emphasis on science largely explain the amplitude of damages as a result of the January 12, 2010 Haitian earthquake.
On retrouve ici le questionnement de plusieurs types de droits humains. Le droit à l'information, le droit à l'éducation, le droit au logement, le droit à la sécurité, le droit au progrès, mais également le droit au travail, le droit d'un pays à concevoir et à mettre en œuvre de manière autonome ses politiques économiques.
We find here then questioning of many types of human rights. The right to information, right to education, right to lodging, right to security, the right to progress, but also, equally, the right to work, the right of a country to conceive and to put into operation its autonomy in the economic, in its own economic policies.
Alors, vu leur avancée, je rappellerai simplement des éléments de conclusion et perspective, espérant que j'aurai la possibilité de les développer au cours des débats.
Considering that time is advancing, I will recall simply these elements of conclusion and perspectives, hoping there will be the possibility to develop them more during the discussion.
Je dirais que la nécessaire reconstruction d'Haïti passe par les points suivants.
The necessary reconstruction in Haiti includes the following points.
Une meilleure attention à la science et aux droits humains.
Better attention to science and to human rights.
Le renforcement de l'État et des institutions nationales.
The reinforcement of the state as well as national institutions.
La prise en compte des options définies par la nation haïtienne, notamment dans sa constitution.
Taking into consideration, into account, options defined for the Haitian nation, most notably in its constitution.
Une meilleure compréhension d'Haïti par la communauté internationale, dont la présence massive, diverse, multiple, quoique animée des meilleurs sentiments, risque d'être contre-productive, y compris dans le domaine des droits humains.
A better understanding of Haiti by the international community. Such as the presence of a massive, diverse, multiple, and many, many sentiments actually risk to become counterproductive in the domain of human rights.
Et pour terminer, je voudrais offrir comme exemple le processus entamé par la Triple S pour la promotion de la science en Haïti, par son contenu et par les modalités de son déploiement.
So in conclusion, I would like to offer as an example the process undertaken by the AAAS to promote science in Haiti by its content and by the means of its deployment.
Je vous remercie de votre attention.
I thank you very much.
Thank you both to Fritz Desom and also to Marie. Our next speaker is Alex Deegan, who has the rare distinction of not only holding a PhD in evolutionary biology, excuse me, but also a JD. Perhaps it's this combination of training that has led Dr. Deegan to work in the area of science diplomacy in the State Department and currently as the Science and Technology Advisor to the Administrator of USAID. And if I'm not incorrect, Dr. Deegan is also a former AAAS Science and Technology Policy Fellow. Proudly so, it appears. Please.
Excellent. Like many of you, I seem to have gotten some sort of bug, so please don't mind the random hacking. It'll be good pause motions for us. There's a lot of people that actually helped me with this presentation, and I list some of their names above. Adam Reinhart, who's a former AAAS fellow, Maurice Kent, who works for the Office of Science and Technology, Dr. Wayne Pennington, who's a Jefferson Science Fellow who worked down and who went down to Haiti, and Dan Schein, who's our senior innovation and technology, a senior innovation and technology advisor at USAID, who also worked down in Haiti, and they both contributed to this. So obviously, pre-earthquake, we had some problems in Haiti. It was the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. 70% of the people in Haiti were living on less than $2 a day. 86% of the people in Port-au-Prince were living in slum conditions. Half the people in Port-au-Prince had no access to latrines, only a third access to tap water. 1 in 4 children were chronically undernourished. 12% had access to electricity. So we had some development problems when we started to add to the problems of the earthquake. For me, as a conservation biologist and evolutionary biologist, the environmental degradation in Haiti, if you look at the border of the Dominican Republic, I mean, is astounding. 99% of the forests in Haiti are gone. And it's very interesting because when you have a loss of forests, when you have a loss of the ecosystems, you have a loss of the services provided by them. A loss of water, it stops raining, because there's no more transpiration with the cloud cover, with the fog, and you see a loss of pollinators in the region, such as bats and bees and other insects that help improve crop diversity. This species is selenoid. It is actually a species that was found at the time of the Cretaceous-Tertiary extinction event. It was discovered on January 9th, 2009, after thought extinct. It separated from the rest of mammals 76 million years ago. A lot of people thought it was extinct. It's not a shrew, but it looks it's convergent with shrews and like a lot of early mammals at the time. So January 12th, 4:53 p.m., we had this catastrophic 7.0 earthquake 25 kilometers west of Port-au-Prince. 3 million people affected. Somewhere around 230,000 people have died, 300,000 injured, over 1 million made homeless, a huge number of residences lost. And so when we think about the role of science and technology, There's a bunch of different levels we can think about this. One is science and technology is clearly part of development, and science and technology is part of our response to crises, right? So science gives people the capacity to respond to problems. Technology gives us tools that we can use to help better meet people's human rights and their needs in the times of crisis, and engineering is how we rebuild, and engineering is the application of science and technology to actually addressing these challenges. The traditional tools were pretty clear. We had an initial response. The immediate response phase happened almost after the search and rescue teams were on the ground, and this involved USGS and Earthquake Engineering Research Institute doing fast reconnaissance, fast reporting, trying to assess what the situation on the ground with, providing a seismic hazard map. And this built on the work of a guy named Eric Calais, who in 2008 actually did a presentation to the Haitian government of the earthquake risks that we had. Understanding that there were new faults and understanding what the future fault risk was necessarily not only for stabilization of the populations that were there, but also in terms of the long-term reconstruction. Science and the USGS, the U.S. community actually provided both through NASA and the military satellite imagery and drones to best understand, you know, where were there landslides, where were the buildings that had collapsed that people had not realized, what were the fault risks that we were looking at, how do we determine that from the landscape patterns. And in terms of, you know, the geospatial center, there was an existing geospatial center in Haiti. I think a third or more of its of the people who had worked in the center, including the director of the center, who was very active, had actually passed away during the earthquake. They were key in terms of any effort to do reconstruction, any effort to actually communicate where the damages were in terms of planning any sort of long-term strategy. And we're now trying to actually rebuild sort of that capacity to do so, but it is a long-term process. NSF funded a series of grants called Rapid Grants, and that was to essentially collect data, because we needed these sources of baseline data for Haiti, and that is for civil and environmental engineering, geotechnical data, structures, earth sciences, social sciences, information technology to do this. And one of the big questions and one of the problems that we saw is we saw this shift in the scientific community. The scientific community generally in response to disasters wasn't one to actually move forward and serve alongside the development community. Usually they were there to collect data to understand the scientific aspects of the earthquakes, of volcanoes, of what was going on the ground. But it was rare that we ever saw the scientific community engaged in the way that they had in Haiti, and I think that was a plus. One of the things we need to figure out as we're looking at Haiti is what is, how do we better coordinate among those communities in the future? How do we actually allow for the sheer number of people who wanted to reach out to the suffering that they saw in Haiti to do so in a way that actually allows for prioritization of that outreach and allows for that data and that expertise to be used most effectively, both for the short-term needs and for the long-term needs? We're shifting, obviously, from the humanitarian recovery efforts to the long-term reconstruction. And that means continued focus on shelter, health, buildings, and agriculture, first and foremost. Access to water. How do we actually rebuild Haiti beyond where it was pre-earthquake? So not just to get back to restitution, but actually get to what we hope will be a much more resilient country in terms of not just seismic shocks, but also in terms of economic shocks, in terms of climatic shocks, in terms of environmental shocks that it was heading down a path for. The other thing we saw was we saw a series of new tools, of more innovative tools being used within science and technology to address the problems in Haiti. We saw this thing called Crisis Camp Haiti, which was what were called random hexakinas, groups of hackers, of computer programmers that started to work together to actually provide services to people on the ground in Haiti that would allow them to be crowdsourced. So rather than the traditional sort of top-down approach, this was one where they could take all the data that was on the ground and make use of that data in a much more useful way to all the participants who were doing relief efforts in Haiti. One of the things they did was create a base layer map for Port-au-Prince, create a new collection of imagery and the data that goes into the imagery, family locators for quake victims, and a way to be able to catalog through text messages, through phone calls, through other means, you know, where people were, when people were found, and how to connect them with their families. Better relief information and coordination of that relief information and a mechanism to do so. And Crisis Camp brought together the domain experts, developers, first responders, development experts, and in sort of a new way that was quite good. And we saw little groups of these camps around the country. One of the things that they did was built this thing called an open street map. And because the maps in Haiti were so far out of date, we saw actually people contributing, noting where the blockages were in the road, noting where the hospitals had collapsed. That type of data was not readily available, but it was crowdsourced, it was provided by people on the ground, and it developed actually the best map that was then used in Haiti to coordinate for relief experts. It was based on 80,000 text messages. 3,000 of these were used in response activity, geo-reference data that were gleaned from Twitter, from blogs, from news media, humanitarian situation reports that were all put together into these highly detailed maps. And this is a screenshot from the state of the map as it is today. And this has now been taken over by Haitians themselves. There was already a phenomenal problem in terms of limited access to financial systems in Haiti. And this is actually true of other places around the world. We have problems with corruption in Afghanistan. And how do you distribute money in places where that infrastructure isn't there? In Haiti, it was 10% of Haitians' population had access to those financial systems. And the Haitian Mobile Money Initiative, which was a USAID Gates Foundation partnership, was helped launch mobile money services to allow people to essentially transfer money through their cell phones, leapfrogging over traditional financial systems and allowing for the foundation for truly advanced banking systems that could help lift a lot of people out of poverty, to help do microfinance, to help essentially take development efforts from focused on the pure state sector and actually spread it through the population and work to help people solve themselves. You can use your cell phones to make deposits and withdrawals at retail outlets, transfer money, and pay bills, for instance. In Afghanistan, we had a really fundamental problem of corruption in terms of soldiers weren't getting payments. This allowed us to sort of remove that middle person that was responsible for the corruption and allow for those payments to go directly to the soldiers. Mobile voting, and also the access of connectivity. And there are initiatives underway to greatly increase the connectivity of 80% of Haitians in the country. And this is a fundamental problem in development. It is a fundamental, you know, and there's a question, and we can talk about it in a few slides, actually, as to whether or not this is, you know, the right to connectivity, the right to knowledge, and the right to information is a human right to some extent. Because we're seeing this position of the connected around the world and the unconnected within these great ungoverned voids. And what that means for the international security, but also for the security of the people who live in those regions. There are great efforts right now about to be launched to improve broadband access, which also helps us with mobile banking infrastructure, which helps us with getting people access to knowledge that they need to be able to solve their own problem. The introduction of mobile voting also gets rid of sort of the inefficiencies of paper ballots and also, again, allows us to move democracy to the people, allows for checks and balances and a fair election in a place in Haiti where people can have more trust within the system. In development, we've got a fundamental problem, and development has really changed. We, you know, 30 years ago, even 20 years ago, the world was really only a few development agencies. They took a very top-down approach and Western approach to what countries needed, what they felt countries needed, and what they didn't needed. They used 5-year planning mechanisms that were very similar to what the Soviet Union was doing to build its own economy. The world is actually a very different place now. And even though And there needs to be a movement within what we're trying to do away from focusing on a few development contractors and actually increase the number of development experts around the world, increase the number of opportunity, increase the opportunities for people who can offer potential solutions. There's absolutely no shortage on good ideas, but there is a great shortage on the opportunity available to people around the world. One of the ways in which we're trying to do that within USAID and within other parts of the International Development Community, such as the Rockefeller Institute, Rockefeller Foundation, is to use a tool called Open Innovation. And that is the idea of using things like prizes and challenges to increase the number of solvers and increase the number of solutions that are available to development agencies. There's a reason for this. With a prize, for instance, you only pay for success. Frequently, the people who are applying for the prize invest 10 times the amount of the prize in actually coming up with a solution. The solutions come from sectors that people never expected. NASA's Space Glove came from a group of engineers working with theater experts that had not been involved in the space before in terms of their development marketplace. And you draw a lot of attention to the key problem. And as we think about fundamental problems in Haiti, we need to think about broadening the potential solutions that are out there. Haiti still has 500 refugee camps around Port-au-Prince, 500,000 people living in camps, over 100,000 at critical risk from storms. Those storms have a greater impact because of that environmental degradation. There are 1,100 camps across the country, 54 with our home to 500 people or more. And people in these camps are actually not happy. They don't have the full access to services. They don't have access to information. They've been in these camps for a long time. And one idea, for instance, is to think about what would a prize for building refugee camps of the future that could have a minimal or zero impact on the environment. They're scalable. They're renewable, involve renewable energy that provides sanitation and clean water and that are networked. As we move away from the traditional approaches to science and technology or the traditional approaches to development, we can think about some of these more innovative approaches to be able to use a combination of methods to find solutions to these problems, particularly in crisis situations, but also for the long-term reconstruction capacity. So this idea of a human right to development, development is really focused on two poles. On one part, there is the moral imperative for development. This is why people work at USAID. USAID has the highest among U.S. federal government agencies degree of ownership among its workers in terms of their support for the mission of the agency, 91%. I think the next federal agency is NASA, somewhere down at 80 or 70%. But the other part is development is part of our national security strategy and our diplomatic strategy. And the fact is, it is a continuum on which we see shifts moving back and forth. And there are some fundamental questions. Should our foreign policy and development strategies reflect our internal values? Is there a right to science and technology? There was a great flyer outside that argued, yes. Is there a right to knowledge? How far does that right go, fundamentally? Generally, when we think about human rights, those obligations are put on governments. But there's a lot of those obligations that could be interpreted as rights to development. Everyone has a right to liberty, life, and security, a right to a standard of living adequate for health and well-being of families, a right to education. And there's some new evolving rights that are coming out. Future generations and the responsibility of the present generation, the future generations. A right to a clean environment is one that's increasingly being called for. And the right to protection of biodiversity is a common concern of humankind. There's even this idea of water as an indispensable right, if you see it as a right for life, liberty, and safety. And in 2009, Finland made the right to broadband web access a legal right. So there is an implicit growing body of state practice, and it is through the accumulation of state practice you rise to some forms of international law that we see calling for rights to what could be considered science and technology. It is clear that that if we're going to be able to resolve the problems in Haiti, and we recognize that development itself is a technical discipline. It is a discipline of physical sciences, including seismic engineering and geology. It is a discipline of biological sciences, such as agriculture, global health, biodiversity conservation. It is a discipline of economic sciences and anthropology to understand the context in which it's placed. It is a discipline of financial sector and of business. All those sciences play a part in terms of understanding development. And our fundamental goal in terms of how we respond to these crises must ultimately to help countries build their own capacity to solve development problems, to build the resiliency so that they can set up their own standards, for instance, that are in terms of building codes that are more can better withstand earthquake risks, that can, in terms of zoning practices, that can help for regeneration of the forest that will provide clean water. In this sense, we move from a handful of development agencies to 6.7 development agents around the world, and that should be one of our goals. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and you'll forgive me, I hope, before I introduce the next speaker. I can't help but add to the references that Alex Deegan gave from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Also, Article 27 of the Universal Declaration says that everybody, all of us, have the right to benefit from scientific advancement, and I think that's also quite relevant. Thank you, and our next speaker is Fritz Scheuren. A statistician by training and experience, he exemplifies one of the goals of our Science and Human Rights Coalition. He recognizes the role that science can play in addressing human rights matters and has given of his time through Statistics Without Borders and independently to human rights projects in many countries, including Haiti. Dr. Scheuren is also author of the book Statistical Methods for Human Rights. Thank you.
I was sitting next to the person who's keeping the time, and he's very good. And I told him that I would not use all of my time. So there you are. Mike Cohen, who's handing out a brochure, there's not enough for all of you, I'm sorry, Statistics Without Borders, which features the work that we did in Haiti, but also a number of other activities on human rights area. I'm actually going to talk primarily about Haiti. I just came back from Haiti, and I will develop that a little bit more for you in a moment. But I'm going to put my cheaters on. That's one of the technologies that we have as scientists. We're allowed to use cheaters. Glasses. Anyway, Statistics Without Borders, Mike, I don't think you had enough, but what I would recommend those of you who didn't get it to see me afterwards. I do have some business cards. This is what Mike was handing out, Dr. Cohen was handing out. He was a former president of the American Statistical Association's chapter here in Washington, Washington Statistical Society, and a good friend. Thanks, Mike. I'm going to say a little bit about the work we did in Haiti for Statistics Without Borders and the work which we did in March. And I was down there, and the work we've just finishing now on the elections, which are not the work is not finished yet. So some of that I can't really share with you because it's embargoed. But since the actual results have already been leaked on the internet, I'll say a little more than I would have otherwise. First, let's talk about the difference between first responders and second responders. I think you all know about first responders. First responders are the people who go down there, go down wherever, and do things to help people. They're physicians, nurses, medical people. They're also people who clean up things, dig things out, bury bodies. Sadly, very many in Haiti. And that work began right after the earthquake, which would be a year ago tomorrow. And there, I can tell you a lot of people went down to Haiti. The hotel was pretty empty when I first got there a couple weeks ago. And it was pretty full when I left because people are there to commemorate this event. And there'll be a lot of media attention, I hope, and I hope to good effect. But anyway, the second responder is a person who switches from focusing on data, the actual individual that's in front of you who needs to be helped, to focusing on information. And that's where statisticians come in. Our job is to turn data into information, hopefully good data, into better information, a distinction which may be a development later, but maybe not. It should be obvious. There are some of you who are statisticians in the room and would know that distinction. But anyway, so I went down in March with Statistics Without Borders. I was on my own nickel, and others went with me, Justin Fisher and Jim Ashley, who were statisticians, and they were being partly funded by a Haitian-American who's a statistician. It's in North Carolina, John Orion, and he contacted the president of the American Statistical Association, Sastre Pentuli, then president, and he said he wanted to contribute some money if there would be some people who would volunteer their time so he could get something happening. And he went down himself, and I met him first in Haiti. And of course, it wasn't our money, our resources that we were, that was going to be spent. It was, in fact, to hire people who would do the work. And since we were going to do a survey, to pay the responders as well. You've already heard from the previous speaker that one of the innovative ways that you avoid the middleman, as he put it, is to do things directly through the cell phone companies. So people would be responders, and they would get credits, cell phone credits, to use as part of their response. It was quite a good arrangement for them. And those of you who do telephone surveys or know about telephone surveys have hung up on telephone surveys. I think more likely you're that last group is the predominant one in this room. You realize that people aren't too interested in answering questions on the phone. Not in a developed country like the United States. That wasn't true in Haiti. I'm an emotional person, so excuse me if I lose it every now and then. I apologize to you. When we would, because it was polite, we'd leave a message that we had called. In Haiti, people call you back. They call you back. Never happens in the United States. People never call you back in the United States. They call you back. And so we had a very, very high response rates. We use cell phones only, even though there are land phones in Haiti, but they were not functioning. This is early March to mid-March, right after the earthquake. And actually, if you know much about the developing world, people don't use landlines very much anymore anyway. And in prediction you can make yourselves about the United States, pretty soon we won't be doing very much of them either. We're in the enviable position of being the only country in the world where you have to pay for the cell phone both ways. Nowhere else in the world is that true. If you call somebody, you pay. But if they pick the phone up, it's free for them. And it was free in Haiti. But in the United States, you pick the phone up, cell phone, you have to pay too. This is something we ought to change here. And once we do change the number of cell phones, onlys will go up even more. But in Haiti, it was one direction only. All you had to do in Haiti was to have the electricity to use the cell phone. What the Haitian government and the Haitian cell phone companies did was they stopped collecting payment. There was a small payment that you paid to have a cell phone. They stopped collecting it. And so there was no loss in cell phone access. If you had that electricity, you got access. And we had instances where people working in the camps were charging cell phones, which they had to be paid, but the amount was very, very small. And right after the earthquake, despite the devastation and despite all the other problems, the bottom part of the strata in Haiti were actually slightly better off. Middle class were not better off, and the rich were not affected. If you were in Haiti and you went around Haiti, you saw that the houses of the rich were standing unchanged by the earthquake. The houses of the poor were completely gone, but they were not much to worry about anyway, since so many people, especially in Port-au-Prince, were living in slums. And those people are now living in tents. And I'll come back to talk about living in tents in a minute, because living in tents is a serious problem long term. But anyway, cell phone only was what we used. It worked very, very effective. We had a very high response rate, I've told you. Coverage rate was pretty good around Port-au-Prince. The cell phones were for the whole country, but parts of the rural areas are not completely covered. They do not have cell phone access. Those, however, are the parts of the country that were not as affected by the earthquake. So that maybe didn't matter that much. The cholera epidemic, which is ongoing in Haiti, is an interesting paradox. Cholera has never happened in Haiti before, to my knowledge. The belief was that it was a first responder that brought it with him. Don't know if that's true, but that was the rumor. But anyway, Haiti's cholera problem is serious. Interestingly enough, the people that living in the tents were getting water, clean water, provided by the U.S. Army and the Canadian Army, because they were both there when I was there, and by other international organizations. And that water was clean, and so they were not getting cholera. You know, cholera is a waterborne disease. The cholera was occurring outside the camps, but it was bad, and it was, and still is bad. And people are kidding about it now, people who are living in Haiti are kidding about it now. They've this little business with the bump, if you know about that, now very common in the U.S. It was very common in Africa. I work in Africa. I was actually in Africa on the 12th of January in a country called Lesotho, which is entirely inside South Africa. So I was unable to do anything on that day. But anyway, the cell phone access worked. We would like to repeat that cell phone survey again with the same respondents and the same interviews. We actually built a team of an infrastructure process which is repeatable. And, of course, one of the things that I've been doing, I'm not supposed to do in Statistics Without Borders, is to go around and try to put the hand out for the money. I need $13,000 to do the darn thing again, okay? To talk about people who were... what happened to them? Did the cholera affect them? Because this came before the cholera. Can't get the money. Like to. I'm saying it now because maybe some of you have $13,000 in your pocket. Anyone have it? Right, available? Perhaps not. Anyway, it's a problem. And it needs to be done. We need to repeat measurement in a place that has environmental risks and has other problems in order to see whether progress is being made. I went down there again, I just came back on Saturday night, and some of the people I saw said things were getting better. Well, they've cleared some rubble. Maybe they're getting better. I hope so. But they're not really very different than when I remember them in March, right after the earthquake itself. I'd like to see what the people think. I'd like to see whether they think it's getting better. I was going down there to work on the election. It was an election this fall in Haiti, presidential election and parliamentary elections. And it was a considerable amount of controversy about the election. It was believed to be a considerable amount of fraud committed. So the OAS, which has invited me down, it was one of the people who went down, the OAS sent a team down, invited by the Haitian government, to take a look at what happened. This is one of those things. Citizenship and voting is one of those central issues. One of the speakers, the first speaker, talked about using modern electronic techniques. This was not done that way. This was paper ballots and around the country. And each of the polling locations, we call them precincts here, had about 450 registered voters. But they had something which we don't use in the U.S., and we do perhaps in some other countries. The only country, by the way, who runs well-run elections is Canada, that I know of. They really do a great job. The United States is not one of the countries that does a good job on elections. Sorry. I work on this. I have a book on elections. Who remember Florida? All of you are old enough to remember Florida, right? Did any of you vote in Florida? You might have. Anyway, we're not good at elections in the United States, even though we've been doing them longer than anybody else. It's amazing. But anyway, Canadians do a good job. So a couple of Canadians with me. There was an international team. Everybody spoke French except two of us. The election official from Jamaica, who was on the team, and me, who I don't even speak English, as I told you. But anyway, you already know that now. So we went down there to work on the elections, and it was a very intense process, and I'm still pretty tired from it. But I had a great team, and I learned a lot from them, and I learned a lot about what we're trying to do in a country like Haiti in order to give them the kind of civil society that they need in order to change themselves, not to be changed by us, but to change themselves. And I'm having a little change of down here too as well. Did that change in create the other change? Anyway, so the elections, we did uncover fraud. Fraud is one of those technical terms that you actually can't say with certainty. We uncovered irregularities which were sufficient to make us believe that there was a direction to the errors that were being made. Errors get made in all elections everywhere all the time. These errors seem to be directional. And the people have to have a SIN number, an ID number in order to vote. And those ID numbers were many times fabricated, not available, not correct. And there was a distinct pattern in one of the candidates had more of the problems than the other candidates. The leading candidate, a woman, there was no evidence at all that that any of her colleagues had committed any kind of irregularities in her name. But the second candidate did have serious problems. And we, since this is on the internet already, we changed the order of the second and third candidate. The second candidate was changed to the third candidate, the third candidate second. I think that was probably enough because there's a revote that's going to take place and the top two candidates will revote. The other candidates, who are another 12 candidates, had very, very few votes. And I don't think that they were affected. Their rank ordering would have been affected by a separate, complete vote over, which was one of the things we considered recommending was not recommended. Let me talk a little more about capacity building and about the way you have to think about human rights issues in settings that are not your own country. Obviously, my parents. I didn't say this, but my parents both spoke French. I'm very part Canadian, so anything I said about Canada that was positive, you can downplay that if you want to. I think it's true. But I think that what you need to do is to find a way to get the people there who are fantastic to work on their own problems themselves. And they're willing to do it. I've been in other countries, many other countries, and usually in developing countries, not developed countries, there are some fantastic people that could do a great job, but they don't have an infrastructure around them to do it with. All of us in America have deep infrastructures that allow us to find the right niche so we can do our job, whatever our job is. That isn't true in developing the world. And it has to be what you change. And by putting in place a cell phone only team to do cell phone surveys, we actually did that. And we could continue it. These were students and professors. The professors were, in fact, running the operation, and the students were the interviewers, and the, of course, the respondents were getting paid, so it was a good thing to do. I'd love to see that done again. I think the commemoration, the memorial tomorrow, is a good point at which to recommit to Haiti. A lot of words were said about commitments to Haiti, but as you know, when all is said and done, more is said than is done. But that doesn't have to be true about Haiti. It's a wonderful country, a wonderful people, and you go down there, you fall in love with them right away. You are put off by the poverty, which is incredible. It's so different from America. Even from the deepest parts of Mississippi, it's not as bad as it is in Haiti. And I've been in those deep parts of Mississippi, too. Anyway, thank you for giving me this time, and God bless you. And I will pass the hat later. Bye.
Thank you. We have one final speaker. I will seek your indulgence and ask that we cut into the morning break slightly so that we do have some time for question and answer after our final speaker, at which point I'll invite all the speakers to come to the table. Our final speaker this morning is Emily Jacoby, and she co-founded in 2008 Digital Democracy, which, as its name suggests, aims to use digital tools to increase media literacy and to amplify the voices of marginalized communities. I leave it to Emily to describe the project that Digital Democracy has developed in Haiti. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I also have a little bit of a bug. I think it's just a cough now, but I apologize if I have to cough too much. It's really an honor to be here. As I've learned so much over the past few years, Haiti is a country that suffers from really grave human rights abuses and challenges. And so I think it's a very fitting beginning to today, and it's an honor to be among this group. Digital Democracy, as Jessica explained, is a group that I co-founded 2 years ago in 2008, really based on the fact that there's an amazing array of tools now available, the increasing ubiquity of mobile phones as well as open source internet applications that allow for people at the margins, really vulnerable groups, to have access and the ability to voice opinions, participate politically in ways that never existed before. And so I'm going to today tell you about the work we've done in Haiti, but also give you a little bit of context and talk about a few programs that we've been involved with, as well as the incredible work of our partners, in the hopes of giving you some ideas and some inspiration for you to apply all of the diverse knowledge that you have from the different fields that you represent to solving some of these intractable human rights abuses, not only in Haiti, but all over the world. So we've done work all over the world. We work in partnership with grassroots organizations. We often do bridge gaps between large development groups or technology groups with the local groups of, 20 human rights workers, a women's organization in Thailand, et cetera. This map does represent the places where we've had projects over the past few years, as well as the X's through the DDs represent countries where not only have we done work, but where just saying the name Digital Democracy could put somebody at risk, and having our sticker on their computer could put them at risk of being jailed. So we are often working in non-permissive environments where we're doing a lot of security trainings and other programs with our groups. But a year ago, We had a group who was in Haiti. They were in Gros Morne in the north, and they were doing research, actually, on savings and how young people approach finances. And they approached us to collaborate with students from Fletcher University, or from the Fletcher School, Tufts University. And they were looking at the savings issue, and they really wanted to not just have a general survey where they're asking questions, but they wanted to approach it in a more unique manner. So they used some of our photography equipment, which we lent to them, as well as our manual for doing photography workshops. And they used photographs to explore these complex issues around savings. And they learned all sorts of things that they wouldn't have thought to ask, like a picture of a building that was a boîte de femme or a bordello. And they learned about all these different kind of complex opinions that the young people they were working with had about the country or their situation. This is the group that they worked with, and our two friends who are in the back, they're the white faces, and they happened to be in Port-au-Prince exactly a year ago, and then the earthquake struck. And we didn't know what had happened to them. We didn't know, you know, if they were safe or not, like so many people. And so that led us to getting really involved in the initial response and the response that the technology community had to the problem. And as Dr. Deegan referenced, there were lots of amazing initiatives that were started not only by the professional development community, but by a lot of volunteers and a lot of cartographers, geographers, tech people. And so this is the example of OpenStreetMap, which you've already seen a picture of. But the picture on the upper left was the map that existed on January 12th. It's pathetic. It was one of the least mapped places in the world. Google had really no reason to ever go and map it. So whereas if you want to find your way around Washington, D.C., you can just pull up Google Maps and find your way really easily. That wasn't the case for Haiti. So the OpenStreetMap volunteers all over the world got together, and that's the map. Let's see. That's the map just a week later, on January 18th, the map that existed. And they took all of that satellite data that was opened up to the public for free. And it wasn't just people in Port-au-Prince who were responding. It was actually largely volunteers all over the world going really deep on the satellites, using their knowledge of GIS to then plot it on the map. And because OpenStreetMap is like Wikipedia in that anybody can edit it, they were able to do that very rapidly. And then crisis commons, the crisis camps. This map is representing where there were crisis camps for the Haiti response. You can see clustered all over the United States, as well as in Iceland, in the UK, in France, some in South America. So it was really this amazing international response that allowed things like the OpenStreetMap to become so detailed. And then that is the map that continues to be used on the ground, whether it was by the search and rescue teams initially or plotting, you know, cases of cholera today. Another product that came out of the crisis camps was Tradui, which is an iPhone app for development workers who don't speak a lick of Creole to be able to, you know, to pull up their iPhone and learn keywords. And then this was Ushahidi. So this is, how many of you are familiar with Ushahidi? It's only a handful. Ushahidi, actually, to give you a little bit of context, it was not created by technologists here in the United States. It was created by a ragtag group of developers from Kenya who, in 2007, when the post-election violence was happening, they wanted to do something. So they made use of the fact that mobile phones are very common in their country, and they created a really simple short code. The original version was pretty basic, but they allowed for anybody to send a message via SMS or to send a web form, fill out a web form, and show plotting on the map where violence was happening, because the Kenyan media wasn't really explaining it. This has evolved over time because it's an open source technology. It's been adapted by people all over the world. It's been translated into multiple languages, which I'll get into in a moment. And here it was the version was in English, French, and Creole, and they were accepting, as Dr. Deegan pointed out, messages from within the country with the help of the State Department, who set up the 4636 number. And over time, they ended up having 80,000 text messages in all and plotting, I think, just around 10,000 of them. This is what it looked like 2 days after the earthquake. This was the team of volunteers from Fletcher. We traveled up to Boston, where our friends were from. We learned that they were all right. A couple of days later, we finally got in touch with them. And their classmates were the ones who started off scouring the web for the text messages, for messages on Facebook, on Twitter, plotting information. And then once the short code got up, it became a much more complicated process. This is kind of a lot of information to take in, but this shows how a Haitian national at the very top can send a message for free via the different cell phone companies, how that got routed through two companies in San Francisco that do crowdsourcing of translation, and then how that got sent to different, based on the information that they had, and once they had it translated into English, they had a team of actually Haitian diaspora in Canada, in the United States, and all over the world who were translating these messages in near real time. It took an average of generally 12 seconds to translate the messages. And then they were routing it to the different information sources that could respond. So the Ushahidi volunteers helped coordinate with the Coast Guard and the U.S. Southern Command. Other groups like NSTED helped aggregate emergency information to get a sense of the trends that were happening and so on. So it was just this really incredible process that happened. And while there were many professionals involved, there were also a lot of volunteers, thousands of them. So for us, as a group that really focuses on human rights, grassroots-led development, what does all of this mean? These are amazing innovations that were clearly useful in the aftermath of the earthquake, but what do they actually mean for the day-to-day lives of Haitians? And how can they not just be used to empower university students in Boston to feel like they can contribute, but how can they empower actual Haitians? That is the essential question. So just to give you some context, we've been working on that question for a while. This is our Ushahidi instance that we built in Burmese and English. The circular font is Burmese language. And in Burma, Myanmar, there's some of the most egregious human rights abuses in the world. It's been a dictatorship for over four decades. We have a lot of contact with human rights groups based in the bordering countries, in Bangladesh, India, Thailand, China. And so we developed, in partnership with a coalition of human rights groups, a system for using mobile phones to communicate more securely, to really map the past decade of information, and to make that information more accessible and actionable. So this is our map of human rights abuses in Burma. It was done with the help of volunteers, as well as aggregating the human rights information for the past 10 years. And there's now almost 1,000 instances of the human rights abuses from the past decade. So it starts with secure communication, secure documentation, and ends with the public information sharing. So as a close-up on those, this is one of the systems we use. It's called GeoChat. It's developed by a group called NSTED, and it uses SMS so that people can share messages via SMS, and then at a group's headquarters, they can actually be tracking where all of that information was coming on a map. It's all can be secure, private information. Second, this is a secure documentation. We've been using a lot of digital pins, other security tools as ways for people to share information more securely. And then third is the public information sharing. So this is the Ushahidi map in Burmese language, looking at some of the human rights abuses. And this is the interface. So this is the back end where people are actually uploading that information, just to give you that context. So returning to Haiti, we knew the handheld human rights had been successful in Southeast Asia. It's been not only successful with the overarching goals of sharing information, but also in getting our partners to think critically about their security concerns and what are the problems that they're most trying to solve, what are the human rights abuses that they most need to share with the world. And so that brought us to Haiti, where we, over the early months of 2010, developed a close partnership with the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti and their Haitian counterpart, the Bureau des Avocats Internationaux, which is French for the International Lawyers Bureau. So the problems you all know. They're numerous, they're widespread, and they're kind of all linked. And the question we started asking ourselves is, okay, there's a lot of reporting. This was last spring. There's a lot of reporting on the problems in Haiti, but who are we actually hearing from? Not only who are we hearing from about the problems, but who's taking part in the conversations about the solutions? And attending the donors conference last March, we realized that there was a major voice missing, a voice that represents one of the most marginalized groups in Haiti, but also half the population, women. Haitian women were suffering some of the most in the camps. Violence was increasing, insecurity was increasing, and women were often the targets. But they weren't being part of the conversations either in at Log Base in Port-au-Prince or certainly in New York at the Donors Conference. So we spent time working with women's groups. There's a really rich history of grassroots women's activism in the country that is actually in response to a history of violence. Rape has been used as a political weapon throughout the different coups. Rape actually was considered a crime of honor up until 2005, where attackers could their punishment for committing rape was simply to pay a small fee to restore a woman's honor, or in some cases to marry her. So these are groups that we worked with. They're really amazing. We did a photography workshop to begin with, because we found, particularly when there are language barriers, particularly when you're dealing, most of the women we are dealing with have had very little formal education. Their literacy rates are pretty low, yet they're very organized. They're very smart. They know what they want and need. So we trained them in how to use cameras, and they went out into the camps to document the situations and the most pressing concerns that they have. These photos that I'm showing you are photos that they took within 12 hours of learning how to use a camera. Of course, we've all seen many photos taken by professional journalists who've gone into the camps, but there's, I think, a power to the photos taken by people living in that situation. They also took photos of water lines, et cetera, really more photos than I have time to show. And they talked about it in editing the photos and choosing which ones that were their favorites or which photos they thought were most important to share. It really became a conversation about, well, what are the most pressing problems to them? Unemployment's one of the largest. And then the issue of gender-based violence. Now, we're working with women's groups that have been focused on addressing gender-based violence. One of the groups we work with, COFAVIV, which translated into English stands for Commission of Women Victims for Victims. They've been around since 2004 and have really been at the forefront of the fight of providing women who are victims of gender-based violence with services, connecting them to a network, owning the name victim and kind of transcending it and not just letting that rule their lives, but actually looking at the power that they have as leaders in their community. So there have been reports, and there's much research that you can look into if you want to know more about gender-based violence in Haiti. Recent reports by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, our partners, Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, and MADRE, which is an international women's rights group. So where we came in was really working directly with the women on the solutions. They have solutions. They have been doing incredible work organizing informal security patrols, distributing whistles, advocating for better conditions in the camps, et cetera. But the problem is that in a society that's really based on social inequality, these grassroots women who can't speak French, who haven't had formal education, they're not being listened to. They're not being incorporated into the decision-making processes. And so there's all sorts of problems that have arisen out of that. There's some simple, I mean, living in a camp for months on end has become a nightmare. But there are some camps that are better than others, and camps where there's joint male and female leadership. Camps where women are really incorporated into the decision-making process on where latrines are placed, on whether or not there's lighting, et cetera. All of those have had enormous measurable impact on the number of rapes and the general well-being of the people living there. So what we've really been developing in partnership with these groups is what is the systemic approach. And it incorporates a few different things. So we're definitely taking advantage of high rates of mobile access. This was a survey done by Internews last March that found that 83% of men and 67% of women in Port-au-Prince had mobile phones. I'm not sure, actually, whether that means just access or actually ownership, single ownership over the phones. We found that most of the women we work with share mobile phones, but they all have access in one way or another. Not all of them can text message, so voice becomes really important, and some of the innovations that happen elsewhere around text messaging are important to keep in mind, the limitations around literacy. And then really taking advantage of the incredibly strong network of these groups. This is a typical Saturday meeting of Kof Aviv. 100 women gathered underneath a tarp. They had lost their clinic. They provide medical services as well as psychosocial support to victims. They lost their clinic in January. They've since rebuilt a clinic, but this was from this summer when they still didn't have a space and they were meeting at another organization's in their driveway. They go around, they share their stories, they talk about the problems that they're experiencing, and they every week are coming up with the solutions on how to address the ongoing situation as it's changed. A few notes about that. Kof Aviv, which is just one of many of the grassroots women's groups, had documented 250 cases of rape and sexual assault in the camps in the first 100 days after the earthquake. That's in no way a comprehensive number of the actual amount of rape and sexual assault happening in the country following the earthquake. It's just a small snapshot of the camps where they happen to have agents. There are no other numbers for the other camps. There has been very little systematic look at the problems, and there's a high rates of underreportage due to issues of shame, lack of response, et cetera, and countless accounts of women who are attacked, go to the police for help, and then get ignored or sent away. Unfortunately, those numbers have only increased. It makes sense. People are still living in tents. And even if they maybe lived in slums or, you know, very poor dwellings before, they usually had doors, and they usually could lock those doors. With a tent, it's not that easy. Even if you close it up, a simple knife cut can allow people entrance to the tent, and unfortunately, there's been high numbers of that. And some, in many cases, the only response the women have are the whistles. And they've trained themselves on how to blow those whistles and, like, seek help and have informal security patrols that will come. But that is literally all that's protecting women from those attacks. And it's not only women. Kof Aviv has documented 801 cases of rape and sexual assault between July 1st and December 31st, 2010. Those numbers are much higher than they were early on, and certain months, like the month of October, there were as many as 100 cases. Again, that's not comprehensive. That's only from the handful of camps that they have agents in. They have 33 agents. I don't mean to beat you over the head with these numbers, but I think it's really important to recognize the enormity of the situation and the lack of response coming from all levels. There are at the high level, the UN has a gender-based violence subcluster within their structure where a lot of the international organizations go and a lot of the coordination happens. But unfortunately, the grassroots women have not been at the table for those conversations. The conversations happen exclusively in French. They don't allow for translation, and they've been repeatedly kept off of the referral cards so that the referral cards that are being distributed by the international groups to where women can get support don't list actually the groups that are providing the best support. This is a problem. And it's a problem that can be solved with actually the power of science and technology. So this was a camp. This is a list that Kof Aviv came up with this past summer of camps where they work. The first column is whether or not there's electricity. The second column is whether or not there's informal security. And the third column is whether or not there have been rape cases. It's really dense, and it's hard to figure out, and it's hard to know whether or not you can extrapolate any information. So we worked with them to create a more visual way to really share that information. And this is what we came up with. The above the line are the number are whether or not rapes have been reported in a certain camp. Each block represents a camp. And below the line are whether there have been no rapes reported. again, it's hard to extrapolate because, as you can see, the majority of camps do not have lighting or security. But in the camps where there is both lighting and security, there haven't been rape cases documented. And that's significant. And even when there have been rape cases documented in those camps, there's still fewer numbers. And information like that is really powerful because in a lot of camps, for instance, because grassroots women have not been a part of the conversations, they maybe have distributed flashlights. But they distributed flashlights that take batteries. And the women who need them can't afford battery replacements. So they work, you know, for a week, and then they're gone, and that's it. The women, when the women have been consulted and been part of the conversation, they insist on solar-paneled flashlights. If you're going to make the investment, make it right so that it actually can continue to work and be successful. So we're really working with these groups to help them harness technology so that their voices don't continue to be marginalized. They're the experts. They know what's actually happening. They just need to be listened to. And there's a variety of tools that can do that. For one, training them simple computer skills. They've been blogging. They've been blogging in their language, Creole, and then we've been translating that into English with the help of volunteers. There's enormous, as we pointed out earlier, there's an enormous amount of people who do want to help and whose skills can be utilized. This is a blog post from December 9th, a day or two after the election results had been posted and when there was incredible violence happening. How much time do I have? I'm over? All right. So this is community mapping, where they're using mapping to visualize the problems. Which I can go into more depth. And then we've monitored electoral violence with help from the U.S. Institute of Peace. That's a picture from the day after. And what we learned overwhelmingly is how much the women have suffered from the violence. They weren't able to effectively participate in the elections for a variety of reasons, lack of ID cards, insecurity, et cetera. And then they're suffering as the protests go on. And then we're setting up a call center this spring that will be providing the comprehensive response. And that is it. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to invite all of the panelists to come up. We don't have, well, we've got negative 10 minutes. But I'm sure there will be several questions in the audience, so I would like to give you that opportunity. What that means, therefore, is that you'll need to take any food and drink that you choose into the sessions that that will start sometime shortly after 11. Yes, if everyone could come up. And there are two speakers available in the aisle, so if you have a question, please just approach one of those microphones, and direct your question after briefly introducing yourself.
I'll begin. We've been using Skype and simple tool, and we've been doing Skype conversations between women in Haiti and people at universities or different nonprofit groups throughout the United States. And it's been incredible because one of the biggest needs that they've voiced is just to feel heard. They feel so lost. They feel nobody's listening to them. And so on our blog, we've encouraged people to write blog posts, that sort of thing. It's the kind of thing that actually sociologists, I think, would be really valuable for. And I think So for me, my answer, my initial thought for you is technology. It allows for conversation to happen without having to take a trip somewhere, without having to go far. But a simple act of solidarity by contacting a group that's doing important work, you know, on the ground somewhere, saying, we'd like to learn more. Can we set up a video Skype chat with you where we have some of our members interact with you? And then from there, you could really, I think, create shared solutions. In terms of websites, I would recommend the blog that our women are keeping. It's actually anonymous for security reasons. They can't have their names associated with it, but it's famparle.blogspot.com, famparle.blogspot.com.
Hello, my name is Jean-Yves Merlus. I'm a professor of geography from at Nassau Community College in New York. I have a question for Mr. Dizom. In your concluding statement, you made a few suggestions or recommendations, and two of them were to first build the Haitian government capacity. And secondly is for the international community to have a better understanding of the ground in Haiti. My question regarding the first one, which is to help the Haitian government build a stronger capacity. What do you make, or how can we address the lack of interrelationship that exists between the state and the nation in Haiti? We have a state that only sees the nation as a source of exploitation. And I say we, because I'm also Haitian. Also, there is no interrelationship between the very elite of the Haitian society and the mass. They also see the peasant in Haiti as a source of exploitation. And of course, we cannot underestimate the international community that is often served as a, that is the gasoline that fuels this division sometimes. You mentioned with the second point, you talk about a lack of understanding of the Haitian. Yes, there's a lack of understanding of the ground in Haiti. Haiti is the world capital of non-governmental organizations or NGOs. But I think it goes beyond just a lack of understanding, but rather there is, we cannot underestimate that there's a plan, a very well-planned agenda for Haiti that is oftentimes, you know, built either here in the U.S., France, or Canada, and then take down to Haiti and impose it upon a group of people. How can we make policies for a group of people without incorporating them into the process? And when I say there's a well-planned agenda, we cannot also underestimate the neoliberal economic policies coming from the international community, that is to say the World Bank or the IMF, and I'm glad you talk about the, briefly, you mentioned the structural adjustment programs that occurred around the 1980s. Is it just a lack of understanding, or how can we tackle the very well-planned agenda? Thank you.
Merci pour la question.
Thank you for the question.
Très pertinente.
Very pertinent.
Et j'ai beaucoup insisté dans mon exposé sur justement la nécessité de renforcer l'État haïtien.
In my exposé, I've very much stressed the need to reinforce the Haitian state.
Parce que ces derniers temps, et surtout cette année, j'ai senti vraiment que nous sommes en train de perdre cet État.
Because during the last year, I felt really we are in the process of losing that state.
Et il me semble que ça peut faire partie du problème numéro un du pays.
And that could be really the number one problem of the country.
Parce que, quelles que soient les bonnes volontés qui peuvent se manifester,
in spite of, the goodwill that may exist,
voyez-vous, moi, enfin, on a constaté que dans nos exposés, il y a une diversité de points de vue, et personnellement, j'ai senti, en écoutant les autres collègues parler, j'ai senti beaucoup de bons sentiments, mais je me dis, vers où allons-nous?
So, listening to my colleagues give their addresses, I've noticed really diverse points of view and a lot of good intentions.
En quoi tout ceci, toutes ces excellentes actions, nous permettent de retrouver notre pays, de refonder, de reconstruire ce pays et d'arriver à quelque chose de plus structurant et qui va au-delà de l'humanitaire, au-delà de du court terme.
Okay. And so I've listened to a lot of great activities and plans for reconstruction of our country, but really we have to go beyond short-term solutions.
Et alors, vous avez posé tellement de problèmes importants que je ne sais pas quel bout les prendre.
So really, there are so many important problems that I don't know which words to put to it.
Alors, c'est vrai que il y a eu, dans le temps, beaucoup de problèmes entre l'État et la nation.
So it's really true that over time there have been a lot of problems between the state and the people.
Et c'est vrai que les problèmes d'Haïti n'ont pas commencé avec le tremblement de terre.
Les problèmes d'Haïti n'ont pas commencé avec le tremblement de terre.
So really, it's true that the problems in Haiti cannot be always addressed in long-term solutions.
Mais j'ai l'impression que plus récemment, le poids de la communauté internationale peut être un facteur tellement déstructurant qu'il m'a paru que il faut peut-être l'adresser de manière prioritaire.
So I have really come to realize that the weight of the international community actually can be destructive.
Il y a une présence internationale en Haïti très forte, très massive. C'est-à-dire que quel soit le domaine dans lequel vous vous mettez, vous prenez le domaine politique, le domaine militaire, le domaine économique, le domaine humanitaire, vous avez une présence internationale très forte.
So, excuse me. In Haiti, in the international community, there's a massive power, political, military, economic, humanitarian.
Et plus cette communauté internationale se fait présente, plus on se sent, enfin, plus on sent que l'État s'effrite et plus on sent que la maîtrise du développement, la maîtrise de l'avenir du pays se perd.
So it's longer, the more the international community is there, the more we get a feeling that the capacity of Haiti to do development may be actually losing ground.
Alors, j'ai parlé d'une méconnaissance fondamentale.
So I spoke of a fundamental lack of acquaintance, of knowledge.
d'Haïti par cette communauté internationale qui peut être de très bonne volonté.
Of Haiti by the international community that could actually be with, in spite of that, with good intentions.
Voyez-vous, Haïti dans le monde est considéré comme un pays très violent, un pays très corrompu, un pays qui constitue un danger, on l'a dit, pour la sécurité régionale.
However, Haiti is considered in the worldview a violent, corrupt country that's a danger to security in the region.
Et je me rends compte que ça a été le cas depuis la naissance d'Haïti.
But I can recall that that really dates from the beginning of Haiti.
Et je pense que les droits humains constituent un point de difficulté entre Haïti et la communauté internationale, et ceci dès la naissance d'Haïti.
And I find that the question of human rights can be a difficult point between the Haitian government and the international community.
Haïti, c'est le pays qui a reculé très fortement les frontières de les frontières des droits humains.
Haiti is a country with a very strong a strong reaction to questions of human rights.
Bon, alors on m'a dit que j'ai pas beaucoup de temps pour continuer à répondre.
Oh, well, sorry. They just told me I have very little time left.
Mais je finirai par dire que ce n'est pas vrai qu'Haïti est un pays très violent. Au contraire, il faut regarder les statistiques. Ce n'est pas vrai qu'Haïti est un pays très corrompu. Ce n'est pas disons comme on le dit, que c'est l'un des pays les plus corrompus du monde. Au contraire, si on voit les faits, et je dirais également que, au contraire de ce qu'on croit, il y a un projet que les Haïtiens eux-mêmes ont élaboré pour maîtriser l'avenir de ce pays. On peut retrouver beaucoup de faits qui montrent comment l'action de l'oligarchie, l'action de d'une partie de la communauté internationale ont empêché à cette à ce projet de prendre corps, et malheureusement ce projet existe encore, heureusement ça existe encore, et c'est inscrit dans la Constitution de la République. C'est-à-dire, si on prend le temps de regarder, si on veut vraiment aider Haïti, il faut chercher à savoir ce que c'est, savoir ce que veulent les Haïtiens. C'est écrit quelque part, c'est écrit, et c'est la loi fondamentale. Il faut se demander pourquoi cette loi fondamentale n'est pas appliquée, et je crois que comme ça, on commencerait par mieux comprendre Haïti.
So here, the world community has an impression of Haiti as a very violent country and corrupt. But to some extent, the facts are to the contrary of that. We're talking about Haitian-based projects that exist and that show how actions can actually progress at the grassroots level. On the other hand, some international community projects exist that are counterproductive. Really, what's necessary is to learn more about Haiti, to learn how things work, to apply fundamental laws so Haiti can better develop.
Thank you. I'm sorry to have to cut us off at this point. For any of you who do have any other questions for the panelists, I invite you to ask them over some coffee that we have served outside. We were intended to start the next concurrent sessions at 11. I suggest we start them at 10 past. That gives you 15 minutes to take a bit of a breather, and I invite you to bring your food and drink into the other rooms in which those sessions will be held. So please join me in thanking the panelists.